This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Da, 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 da!
You sound insane. You realize that?
Yeah.
The whole world got crazy.
Seriously?
Yeah.
It's showtime.
Hey, what up, man fam? It's Brian. I'm hosting a podcast for like the second or third time ever. So good luck with that for the rest of this show. I am here because I am scared of clowns, and it especially terrifies the ever-loving fear out of me. I just don't think I can handle it. So I've been wanting to do an anniversary podcast on the movie we're going to talk about today. And so this seemed like the perfect opportunity. And I'm joined here today to talk Princess Bride by my friend and colleague, Ariel Rada of Geek 101 Podcast. What's up, Ariel?
What's up, Brian? What's up, guys? Glad to be back.
Yeah. So some time ago, you messaged or texted or something and just kind of out of the blue and said, if you guys ever do a Princess Bride episode and I'm not invited, I'm going to be furious. And so I was like, okay, I got you. I hear you, man. So I'm a big Princess Bride fan as well. And this seemed like a good time to knock this one out, since I'm avoiding the main discussion that happened earlier this week. I hope that I'll listen to that episode at some point. Hopefully you've already gotten your regular Mad About Movies hunger filled this week, and this is going to be a fun throwback, and hopefully you didn't miss me too much on the old It. I'm going to start off real fast with a couple of shout outs, and then we're going to shoot the bull for a second, and then we'll get straight into the movie. So all the shout outs for today are from our VIP club. If you don't know what that is, you can go to our website, madaboutmoviespodcast.com, and hit the Patreon tab at the top. It'll take you to that page, and you can pledge the donation of your choosing to help us out, to help grow the show, to help us be able to fund all the terrible movies that we have to watch for you guys. And in addition to that, you'll get some lovely rewards like handwritten notes by yours truly and stickers and access to three or more throwbacks a month that are only exclusively on that Patreon feed. So check that out if you haven't already. But here's your shout outs as we try to get through the thousands and thousands of people that have pledged their support over the last 2 months. So shout out tonight to AJ Bruner, to Jacob Davis, to Garrett Elliott. We have two listeners who are both named Garrett Elliott. And so I think I've shouted out the other one, but tonight it's your turn, second Garrett Elliott. Peter Hanna, Nathan Ivey, Ben Jones, Ashley McLean, Ben Pollock, Blake Reed, Adrian Sims, who is probably the nicest human being I've ever come in contact with in my entire life. I think, Adrian, I know you're listening because you always listen. You should probably be like some sort of life coach or something. You're just such an encouraging presence. He's the best, and you should follow Adrian on Twitter if you get the chance. Thaddeus Towle, Joseph Westfall, Megan DiVietto, and Cecilia Yu. There's a few shout-outs, and we'll do more as we go. We're slowly making our way through all of those names. We thank you guys so much for contributing and being a part of this little family here and this little community, and it seriously means the world to us. So thanks so much. And if you want to be a part of that, check out the website and head over to Patreon and do that. So Adrian, I have no idea we're a little inside baseball. I'm literally recording this at the exact same time as Kent and Richard talking to our friend Joel about It, which is weird. We've never done this before. We're like spreading our wings a little bit. I can't see. Yeah, I can't do it. I can't do it. I wanted to. Here's the deal. So they announced this movie, and I said, nope, no chance. I'll never see that. And then the trailer came out, and it was a really weird experience because that is an incredible trailer. So I was very torn on this looks fantastic. I cannot watch the movie. I kind of like beer muscled myself a little bit, like between trailer one and trailer two. Like I had kind of talked myself into like, I can do this. It's a stupid movie. It's really not that big of a deal. And then the second trailer came out, and then like the full on marketing push where it just feels like that stinking clown is in every walk of my everyday life. And I just can't, watching the second trailer, nearly gave me nightmares. Just the trailer alone. So I just don't think I can do it. My hope is because people have described it to me as like Stranger Things meets a horror, like a real horror movie. And that sounds awesome. And so I may try to watch it when it comes out on, you know, DVD or Blu-ray or Laserdisc or something like that.
Right.
But only if it can be in like a very well lit
room. In the safety of your house.
Middle of the day. Yeah, exactly. Where I can stare at my phone as soon as things get too dicey for me. So I'm scared to death. I think it came out in 1990, I want to say. Regardless, I was like somewhere between 8 and 9 when it came out, the miniseries. And, that was like the perfect time to scare the living daylights out of me for the rest of my life. And truly, I think probably like actually scar me for life. That Pennywise is just so creepy. And if you watch it now, that original miniseries, I don't even know if it's very good, but it's certainly not really that scary. It's just that it came out when I was 7.
Right.
And clowns were kind of freaky to begin with. And then
Tim Curry is scary without makeup.
Oh, yeah, exactly, exactly. And then he turns it, you know, spoiler alert, he turns into a spider. Like the second creepiest thing in the world is a giant spider. So that's, you know, it's not great. I just was, I remember being deeply affected by just the cover of that book and the, you know, the commercials for it and stuff, let alone actually seeing it. So I wanted to throw it to you for just a minute here before we go Princess Bride. I guess more than anything, just general thoughts on, because we're, you know, ramping up to this time of year. It seems like a new horror movie comes out every week, if not two or three of them every week. And so I guess I want to get your general thoughts just on the horror genre as a whole. And if there's a movie or quickly a couple of movies that that have have deeply messed up your entire life the way it apparently has for me.
Well, I mean, historically, I was exposed to horror films at a very young age, maybe 5 or 6. Thanks, Mom. So I was traumatized for a little bit, but as I got older, I kind of got over it. And, it takes something kind of almost revolutionary for me to really enjoy a horror movie. Because everything's been done, right? Like you look at something like The Conjuring, a very well made horror film, but still a largely paint by numbers horror film. I watched like The Witch, which came out recently, and it was the most boring thing. Like they tried too hard and it was boring. But if you look at something like Cabin in the Woods, which we mentioned on our podcast this week, by Drew Goddard, who is recently hired to do X-Force. So Brian, you might want to check out Cabin in the Woods before checking out X-Force.
I've seen Cabin in the Woods. I have seen Cabin in the Woods. That's one of the like 5% horror movies that I've seen.
Right. But it takes something like that or Get Out or like The Ring when it came out back in like 2003. God. But it takes something kind of like extraordinary for me to really enjoy a horror movie. And I think it is just was done so well. I just watched it the other day and it's so different. But like, you know, Sinister and The Conjuring and Insidious and all of these things that whose names just meld and mix. And I can't figure out what it is anymore because it's all the same thing. And that is the criticism behind horror films, right? Like horror films and like comedies of a certain kind, the criticism is like, oh, you're all the same thing. An action movie, you know, most movies in general. But I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy good, unique, creative horror films. Like I can watch an action movie no matter what, you know, if it's like, yeah, I can watch 500 versions of John Wick and I'm going to enjoy myself. But you'd have to make something like Get Out with the social commentary, or It, mm-hmm. which is Stranger Things plus the, you know, a scary clown. Or It Follows was very good, and Cabin in the Woods, which is a satire. So, like, I love unique and creative horror movies.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I've said before on the show, I'm in this weird spot where I don't enjoy the vast majority of horror movies because I can't get past how cheesy they are, or how extremely similar to every other horror movie.
Right.
You know, they tend to be, or the exact opposite. Like, the really good horror movies are usually the ones where I'm just like, well, I'm going to cry now for the rest of my life. And then I just can't, you know, I can't get past that. And so I can't like, the slasher movie doesn't, like, affect me, but I don't like the genre. And so I don't really want to sit through it when I'm just like, man, this wasn't a very good movie.
Right.
And then if you get into things like, you know, witchcraft and devilry and stuff like that, and ghosts and things, I'm a very sensitive soul apparently, and I can't handle it. A couple years ago, I'm sure I've told the story on the show before, but we get new listeners, at least one new listener every day, so say the metrics. But a couple years ago, we went to Comic-Con here in Dallas, and they like gave us this huge, this great press pass and gave us a tour and took us around like we were actual celebrities and stuff. It was kind of cool. And one of the things they featured, you mentioned Insidious and Sinister. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was an Insidious sequel, but it might have been a Sinister sequel because they are the exact same
right.
thing to me.
That's why.
Yeah, but they had a trailer, like some sort of VR experience set up for Insidious 3 or something. And you went into this trailer and sat down and put the headset on, and then all these creepy, terrible things happened. And Kent was all for it, and so he went ahead of me and went in, and I sat down in the chair, and they put the headset on, and I closed my eyes for about 4 minutes until it was over, and just, like, tried to block out the creepy noises, because I knew if I open my eyes, I will never unsee what is happening in front of me right now. And so I just walked out, and Kent was like, had this look on his face, like, this is going to be so great seeing how freaked out he is. And he's like, what'd you think? And I literally just like, well, I kept my eyes closed the entire time. He was, I've never seen somebody who was more disappointed than Kent was in that moment. But, so anyway, I hear you liked it. Everybody seems to like it. I really want to see the movie at some point. I can't do it. Can't handle it. Handle it in theaters as it is. So hopefully it'll come out on like DVD or something late December to where I can check that out before make end of year lists and all that good stuff, and maybe potentially still be able to sleep. So that's the goal anyway. All right, dude, that was fun. I want to give us all the time we can for Princess Bride, so let's take a little break here, pay some bills, and we'll be back in just a minute. Hey, man fam, it's Brian here to talk to you today about our newest sponsor, Mack Weldon, a premium men's essentials brand. When we got these guys as our sponsor, I went to the website, I browsed through their categories, I picked out what I wanted and ordered it, and in a couple of days, it was on my body. And these are the most comfortable boxers I've ever worn in my life. The socks are dope, and the shirts look great. They don't have any thongs yet, but I know that Richard has put in a request, so maybe that is coming down the pipe soon. And if for some reason you don't like your first pair, Mack Weldon will refund your money and let you keep your order, no questions asked. I don't think that's going to be a problem, though, for you, because these products look and feel great, and they're awesome for pretty much any occasion. Whether you're going to the gym, you're at work, you're on a date, you're at home watching Now You See Me, whatever else you weirdos do, it's awesome. So go to MackWeldon.com and use our promo code MAD to get 20% off your order. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MAD. All right, we're back. We're going to talk again about The Princess Bride, 1987. So we're at what? How many years is that? That's 30 years. 30 years for The Princess Bride. That seems crazy. Ariel, I know you're a big fan, so I want to let you start us off. Give us kind of your connection to the movie and your general thoughts, I guess. I'll say up front, we're going all in. I'm not going to do spoiler.
It's a 30-year-old movie.
Oh, well, yeah, it's a 30-year-old movie. Pretty much everyone's seen this movie. We're not doing spoiler alerts, so anything's fair game. But But I want to get your, I want to know why you're, you know, you have this attachment to the movie and what your general thoughts are. And then we'll go more in depth from there.
Well, growing up, my dad is a huge fan of the like old school adventure, old school fantasy movies. Like Willow is like one of his favorite movies. And I'll admit Willow's, you know, it's good for its time. Oh, I don't know. But like, it's you know, one of those cult classics. Mm-hmm. But when I finally got introduced to The Princess Bride, it's just like, it was so funny. And it was like, there's all this adventure. And the way like the grandpa describes the book in the beginning is exactly how I felt. Like, oh, of course there's fencing and fighting and, you know, and princesses and blah, blah, blah. And it's just one of these movies that has kind of, you know, developed as a genre of its own that nobody has been able to replicate and nobody has really even tried.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a movie like Stardust, which came out in like 07, 10 years ago. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of like The Princess Bride, except that I think The Princess Bride is, it's not good.
Yeah.
But like The Princess Bride is so good and it incorporated all of these great fantasy elements. Mm-hmm. That's not an epic, you know, it's like your traditional fantasy elements that I think it's kind of shied people away from doing it, right? It's like if Saving Private Ryan came out and nobody else wanted to make a World War II movie, that's kind of what I feel. Mm-hmm. This is in my top 10 all-time favorite movies. So like for me, it's like Pacific Rim, Logan, Saving Private Ryan, Captain America, and like, you know, stuff like that, like Star Wars. Like this is up mm-hmm. there with me, The Princess Bride. Like, I love Carrie Ells in the role. Like, I love Mandy Patinkin, even though his name bothers me for some reason. Like Andre the Giant is amazing. Like, I want to buy all of this like Obey merchandise, and I'm just like, I don't like all this hype stuff. But man, I love Andre the Giant. But yeah, it's really hard to explain because it connects to my childhood in such a way. But you rewatch it, and the writing is just so great, and the comedy, like. It has staying power, right? It's mm-hmm. aged very well, you know, over 30 years. It's hard for me to put into words how much this movie like, connects with, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. This is one of the rare movies that, for me, because I have this weird brain that categorizes everything and like archives every moment of my pop culture life. Like I generally remember, especially a movie that I've seen multiple times. I remember the first time that I saw it and, you know, who I saw it with and why I saw it and so on down the list. And this one exists in this weird place. It's partly because it came out when I was 4. And so it's been around for my whole 14? Life. But you shut it. No. that's part of it. But this is a movie that even Star Wars, I remember from... age 3, maybe even younger, I can remember, you know, watching Star Wars and playing with Star Wars action figures and acting out the scenes from Star Wars with like special effect noises and stuff like that. Princess Bride is just this weird sort of, it's just all, it feels like it's always been there. It's just like it's always been a part of my life for some reason or another, and so it occupies an odd space. My uncle growing up my uncle Randy had a huge collection of VHS tapes, you know, recorded off of TV, which right. is such a weird.
My mom did too.
Yeah, it like everybody in my era, that's what we had, pre DVD, and really for a lot of people pre cable. You know, you had it's a just a weird thing that. No, like my son will never understand why in the world we had all these VHS tapes. And like, well, what do you mean you had to fast forward through 3 hours to get to what you're trying to watch and stuff like that? I mean, it's a very singular for the time period sort of thing. But my uncle had hundreds of tapes and would, you know, we'd get together for family weekends or whatever, like holidays and stuff like that. And my grandparents, and he'd have all these tapes in plastic tubs, and you're just going, and then he had them like index carded so you could find whatever you're looking for and stuff, which was probably part of why I'm such a spreadsheet nerd, is to have, you know, that kind of stuff. But but I just, from probably age 5 or 6, I would imagine, I remember watching this movie pretty much every time we were all together as a family. It just was became like the family movie, and then it slowly became like, I'll watch this movie by myself instead of Robin Hood, the cartoon Disney movie, or Star Wars or something like that. Like, yeah, let's pop in Princess Bride here at, you know, age 8 or something. And what's interesting to me about, there's a lot of great stuff about the movie, but just as far as the film aspect and the presence, as far as like what kind of impact it's had pop culturally, is that it's a cult film, and that surprises me. It was the introduction for me. I didn't know it at the time, but it was the introduction for me to the concept of a cult film, because it didn't make any money when it came out. 30 million total, 4.5 opening weekend. Nobody really cared about it at the time. It kind of came and went, and then, you know, it gets to, I'm assuming, to like HBO or something, whatever, wherever it ended up, and it becomes this huge cult phenomenon, to where I mean, it's certainly not on the level of like a Star Wars, but I feel like it's in the next level as far as you almost never run into a person who is over the age of 20 who hasn't seen The Princess Bride at some point in their life, or doesn't at the very least have like an actual familiarity with the material and what it is. And that's fascinating given, you know, it's very small beginnings.
Yeah, it really is like one of the definitions of cult classic. I mean, it's got a big name director behind it in Rob Reiner. It's got very recognizable faces in, at the time, Cary Elwes and, of course, Andre the Giant.
Mm-hmm.
But like it is just, I think the perfect word for this movie is charming. It's so charming that when like, but it is not like bombastic in any way. It's not blockbustery in any way. So that when people finally, like, you know, you go on HBO and you looked up your TV guide back in the day and it says, oh, it's Rob Reiner, it's Cary Elwes, Andre the Giant, let me check this out. And when they happen to stumble upon it, like the love affair begins. Like that was me at like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old, like watching this, like, wow, I love this movie. It's hilarious and it has such fun characters and such such quotability. Mm-hmm. Like I quote this movie more than I quote me, like probably any other movie. Like, sure. It doesn't have the most famous quotes in the world. It's not like, you know, may the force be with you, right? But if someone says, like, hello, my name is, like, the proper response is, Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepared to die. And it's just that if the movie reaches you, like, if it comes within your sphere of influence, you know, you tend to fall in love with it if you're a well-adjusted human being anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife does not care for this movie, and it's always weird to me. I know we've been in counseling about it for 8 years, but it's always weird to me that this is like a line in the sand for her. She's just like, eh, it's fine.
Okay.
So I think part of it for her is the Overwatch, because there is a, for us at least, I think she's kind of in the same sphere as I was at that age, where it just feels like it was on TV or somebody was putting in the VHS 3 times a week, you know, and you just, it's like a pop song that gets super popular one summer and then you never want to hear it again. I think that's her experience. Whereas I'm just like, no, I'm good. I hadn't rewatched it. I hadn't seen the movie in several years, because she doesn't care for it. And I just had never thought to have a reason for it. But I will say, having rewatched it now, like I'm super stoked to show it to Coop, because I think he'll, you know, maybe not quite yet, maybe another year or so, but I think he'll really get into it. And part of that, I think why this has become a big part of why it's become the cult film and the lasting, enduring classic that it has for our generation. And we're close to the same generation. You're probably, I don't know, there's probably a dividing line somewhere in there, but for yours as well as mine, one way or the other, I think the stroke of genius is phrasing it sort of through the eyes of Fred Savage's character, of the kid.
Yes, absolutely.
And because I think for us, I mean, we both came to this basically at the same time in life. It, you get to, when you watch this movie through his eyes and the way that that it's set up, it, I don't know, it's like it gives you, as an 8-year-old or something, it gave you clearance to like overlook the romance side of things while at the same time you're kind of sheepishly enjoying it, you know? I think that's a really cool concept. I've never read this book. I have no idea if that's how it's set up in Bill Goldman's book, but for whatever reason, like, I think that works perfectly in film and is part of why, you know, it's very family friendly and that helps too. That helps to gather a cult audience for this kind of movie. But it also, I think, is part of what, like, why our generations are so caught up in what, you know, why it's such a good film and why we want to continue to rewatch it. And then you add that to, like, it also has really cool sword fights and pithy dialogue, and the characters are memorable, and that stuff, I don't know, that stuff goes a long way to creating these spots in your brain that, you know, are that when the movie comes on, you kind of light up and you're excited about seeing it again for, you know, the 100th time.
Right. So in regards to the book, I read the book a few years ago for the first time, and I've reread it every other year since, I think, okay. Which is my cycle. I tend to read things every other year. The Princess Bride, the writer, Bill Goldman.
Goldman.
Goldman. He wrote it. The intro of the book says, "Oh, this is an abridged version of the history of this country by S. Morgenstern."
Okay.
And then it goes into a whole spiel about how, like, S. Morgenstern cut out all the boring parts and left this great part of the history and made a book out of it. And, like, and it just, like, comically goes into how people are mad about that. Like, in reality, there is no S. Morgenstern.
Right.
He's just setting up in this book. So I think they want to do something clever. But for the movie, I think you're right. I think it's so brilliant to have Fred Savage there because, you know, you have this high fantasy movie and all the jokes I didn't get until I was 15, 16, right? When I rediscovered it one fateful day. But it allowed you to look at it from, like I said, from, you know, from the eyes, it told you it was okay to look at it like an 8-year-old, that sometimes, you know, a spade is a spade. Oh, it's just a guy rescuing a girl and there's a fight and he does all these things. And this is like, you know, this is like a Hobbit-esque story. He, like, you know, the good guy wins in the end and he gets the girl and they ride off into the sunset, almost literally. Mm-hmm. But then as you have that great nostalgia, right? That feel good fairy tale, which it truly is at its core, and it markets itself to be, you realize the immense layers of comedy and writing and themes behind it that I think allow the film to resonate and inspire you to share it with the next generation at the age that you had discovered it, right? Kind of like Star Wars. You never want to show Cooper Star Wars when he's 15.
Right, right.
You got to show it to him when he's like 5.
Right,
I think exactly. The Princess Bride is, I
or
think that
one and a half, yeah,
right, right, yes. as you're having it playing while your wife's in labor, right? Like,
exactly.
Like that's how to do it.
Yeah.
But I think whether intentionally or inadvertently, it's such a brilliant way that Rob Reiner, you know, and Bill Goldman, who I think wrote the screenplay because he's actually a screenwriter,
right?
It's
very
such a brilliant
good
way.
Screenwriter too. By
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's such an interesting way for them to say, like, this is how you're supposed to watch this movie, with a child's innocence in sense of the plot, which is, you know, not overly complicated by any means, but to have your adult sense of humor and wits about you.
Yeah, totally. No, I think that's, I was going to say the two parts, I think, for why it works so well is the Fred Savage bit to begin with, but also it's a very simple, if you watch this, if you look at this at like the treatment, like the on paper, the one page for what this movie is, it's a very traditional fairy tale. So traditional that I wonder if that may be part of why it wasn't super successful to begin with. I mean, I don't know what it was like 30 years ago at the box office, but I wonder if people said, especially during that was a strange time to release a fairy tale kind of movie. I wonder if people say, like, this looks like something straight out of, you know, like a children's book. I don't really care. Like, it's not going to gather my interest. But yeah, if you look at it on the one page, you say this is like the most traditional fairy tale of all time. but then it's just filled in, you know, so beautifully with these characters and the jokes. And I think Rob Reiner deserves. I'm a big Rob Reiner fan. You know, the last 10 years have been not so great. Right. You know, we all have our ups and downs, and he may have had a few good ideas, and he's just out. I don't know. Regardless, whatever it is, he's not done much lately, and I think that's kind of a shame because it's taken him out of the spotlight, so to speak. Because at one time, you look at his run, where you go, this is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men. That's, and then followed it up not long after with The American President. That's a really incredible run, and it's been, I don't know, that's 20 plus years since of not really having just a whole lot of relevance. But I think he deserves an incredible amount of credit for casting the way that they did. I'm always interested when I go back and we do my research for throwback movies. I love looking at the casts and who auditioned, who they wanted for the role, and yada yada. I always take special note of that stuff, because it's always interesting to see. Typically, when we're doing a throwback movie, it's usually a movie that we all really like, and so we all feel like, oh, well, that's the right person for the role. But maybe it's just that's kind of the nature of the beast. But I'm always interested that, like, oh, that Liam Neeson auditioned to be Fezzik, and how weird and different that would have gone, and that Uma Thurman and Courtney Cox and Meg Ryan were all up for Buttercup before he eventually decided, you know, he wanted to go with somebody that no one had really seen before, and things like that. I think he deserves a lot of credit for getting, for pulling the right strings as far as, like, you know, Carrie was pretty well known at the time. Mandy Patinkin seems like Mandy Patinkin has been the exact same level of fame for 60 years.
Yeah.
And which is great. That's something I love is great about Mandy Patinkin. But Chris Sarandon and Chris Guest and Wall Sean and Andre the Giant, and then having Peter Falk kind of sitting there as, like, this, I don't know, this, like, calming presence, both narratively and for the film as a, like, as it's presented to us, I think. There's not, looking back at, like, who could have been cast here and stuff, there's not a single person from the main 10 or so actors in the movie that you think, yeah, that might have been better if this guy was in place of that guy or something like that. And I think that that's, again, part of what makes the movie last as well as it has. It's just like, these characters are great, but you also, man, they're being brought to life so well. And when you add that into, like, it's basically coloring with colored ink instead of black and white in this very black and white outline. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, so I just think that's part of what has really fleshed out the fleshing out of that storyline makes it so enjoyable and so insanely rewatchable. This has to be top 3, maybe 5 at the worst of movies that I've rewatched the most in my life, I guess.
Oh yeah, this is maybe, I think, number 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. Weirdly enough, my Jackie Chan obsession has, like, totally dominated my rewatchability. So, like, Shanghai Noon is, like, my most watched movie ever.
Goodness.
I'm not like Owen Wilson's whatever, but, like, I love Jackie Chan. You'll never understand. But it's like Dirk times infinity, right? Because, like, there's only one Asian superstar in the world. It's Jackie. But, like, you made such an interesting point about the casting, because, like, even in the 80s, like, this film is just, it's perfect. There's not a single misstep in the cast. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, modern day films that are like well cast. Like, maybe, like, and I can't, like, I mean, like, look at like the Batman movies, right? Like, somebody could have done better than Christian Bale. Like, let's be real.
Sure.
You know, like, Gary Oldman's perfect. Heath Ledger's perfect. Somebody could have been better than Michael Caine. Somebody better than Christian Bale. I mean, you look at the Marvel films, there's been a couple of missteps for casting. Don't get me started on the Netflix Marvel stuff, but but you look at, like, Peter Jackson's films, Edgar Wright's films, like films that are just so cared for by the directors, are just executed flawlessly. And then you look at something like, I don't know, you look at something like The Hobbit that Peter Jackson tried to do, that they really just forced him with millions and millions of dollars, and nobody cares about that movie. But like Andre the Giant, like they wanted Arnold for Andre the Giant, and
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar at one point was in discussion. I mean, it's just kind of all over the place, and landed on Andre, and that's perfect. That's perfect.
Yeah, like and you have like Princess Buttercup, played by Robin Wright, and while she wasn't like, I don't recall anything earlier that she was in, like for her to end up being Jenny in Forrest Gump, but I know you hate that movie. But there's a great like mirror between those two roles, I think, in a sense. And then now with this resurgence with House of Cards and Wonder Woman, like I want to see her in everything. Mandy Patinkin recently lost his father had recently lost his father when he was cast, when they were casting for this film. And so the emotion he gets when he's like, I want my father back, you know, you son of a, that's so real, you know, like it's so good. And somebody who hadn't gone through that experience might not have delivered that role with such emotion. And it's like, wait, wasn't I just laughing? Like when he's like, stop saying that, like, that's a great moment. And it's just, it's kind of like, this is lightning in a bottle, I think, this film.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I think you talked about Batman. I think there are movies that if you give a B director, a B cast, and a B story, and a certain amount of money, they will turn out a B movie 9 out of 10 times, or B or better. I think Batman's like that. That's why Batman v Superman infuriates me so much, because that's my biggest deal. Is like, it should be impossible to make a truly bad Batman movie. And there are other examples of like, I think you can replace this director or this actor with somebody who's lesser known or less, you know, not paid as much or whatever it may be, and they're still going to get a good movie. I think this is a movie that, if you tinker with it, if you replace with this director, if you replace you know, Wallace Shawn with Danny DeVito, or which originally was something that was potentially gonna, my point is, I think this movie gets made in 10 different universes, there are 8 of them that it is either bad, or at the very least is just completely irrelevant from the very beginning, and no one ever cares about. I think that is, to me, that's what you mean with the lightning in a bottle thing. Like, you got the perfect cast, you got the right director, you've got a really well written story by a great screenwriter, and somebody who, it's a passion project for him. He wrote this story for his daughters, and then it comes across as a passion project for Rob. And then you add in the cast, and it's perfect, and it's done. I just think it gets done wrong, most of 8 times out of 10, at least. And instead you have what it is, you know. It'd just be so easy to mess up, we're gonna pour more money into this role than we originally had. Well, now we have Arnold Schwarzenegger, and that's not the same. Like, that just, you lose some of the gentleness that Andre the Giant brings to the role, or, you know, so on down the list. I think you're right. I think lightning in a bottle is the perfect way to put it.
I think this is going to be a weird analogy, and I do not think you might
just
do
it. Kent and Richard aren't here. Let's get weird. Let's see what happens.
I don't think that you would agree with what I'm like about just the next part I'm about to say.
It's fine.
Like,
if the audio goes blank for a second here, you guys will know what happened.
So, this movie I'm about to say is not a masterpiece that I think The Princess Bride is, but it is a very good film. And that's Fast Five.
Okay. And I like where you're going. Let's go. Yeah.
It's a very different circumstance because it's a sequel, but Fast Five is a great heist movie. Mm-hmm. Right. It has all these moving parts and all of these, like all this really good cast and a brilliant director and a fun script and a star wrestler. Mm-hmm. And that movie is incredible, and it has no right to be that good.
Yeah,
but then, and then you look at what's happening with 6, and it's over the top, and it's a little bit too much. And you look at 7, and you look at 8, and the more players they add, and the change in directors, and the change in the cast, and you weren't able to capture that lightning in the bottle that Justin Lin was able to get in that one movie. I think the difference between like 4 and 5 and then 5 to 6 is like it's like a 92 and 80. Like I think it's like a full grade. And I think those Fast and Furious movies are fun, but you look at Fast 5 and how he's able to work with the cast, you know, that big cast and add this star player and you know, have this fun script and great action and the way he works it, like it's they never reach that height again, and it's different because it's a sequel, which spawned more sequels. But like, you know, I can't think of too many. Like, even like George Lucas, like he had the idea for Star Wars. There were some problems here and there with casting. Like Mark Hamill's not a great leading man. Like, there's nothing that really compares. I think the closest thing is like Scott Pilgrim, which sure. I think that all the casting's great, and it's a fun movie, and it's a cult classic, and it's a great director and a great script and an adaptation. But
yeah,
like the you know, lightning the bottle.
Yeah, I think you're the only thing I would argue there is that you said Fast Five was not a masterpiece, and that's clearly
exactly
wrong. That changed the world. Yeah, I'll make another. We just got done. Kent, Richard, and I did. We just got done with the binge session recording 4 or 5 episode throwbacks for the next few weeks, and we talked. One of them that'll be available on the Patreon page was LA Confidential, and that movie, there's a similar experience there where and I talk about this in that review, but just maybe as a teaser or a primer, that movie had a very small budget, very similar to this one, and part of that was the result of the director Curtis Hanson saying, this is a 3-lead movie, we need 3 leads, and I'm not going to cut it down. And the studio wanted him to cut out 2 of those leads, we'll pay one guy whatever $10 million. And he refused to do it. And so instead, he had whatever the money was, he had to split amongst 3 guys. And so instead of getting whoever the big names were in 1997, they end up with Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe and Kevin Spacey, all of whom were maybe not unknowns, but relative unknowns at the time.
I've never heard those names. Who are they?
Kevin Spacey, I believe.
Spacey?
So you end up with those 3 guys, and because of that, it's a movie that the dynamic between those characters works so much better than it would have been if you just have a Mel Gibson was supposedly like the guy they wanted to play who ended up being Russell Crowe. If you have Mel Gibson in that movie, that becomes a Mel Gibson movie. It's no
right,
longer.
Exactly.
This sort of thing. And I think LA Confidential is similar on that as far as the lightning in a bottle thing, because you have the right people at the right time who are just like bursting at the seams to become who they later will become, as partly because of that movie. I mean, this movie, I think it pretty well made the career for several of these people, not just because their characters are so, well-known and beloved. Manny Patinkin talks about how he feels like, I think he said literally every day somebody comes up to him and does the Inigo Montoya bit, and that he loves that. And so I think this movie put so many of these people, some of these guys were certainly around, but this put them on the map, I think, in a more mainstream way, very similar to me of LA Confidential. So we've talked about... a lot of stuff. Is there anything else you want to bring up before we move into the last stretch here and grades and all that good stuff?
I think the sword fight scene in the beginning or in the first third, in the first act, I think it's like, I love action scenes. I love fight scenes. And that sword, well, that's not the most realistic, fight in the world, whatever, who cares. Fencing, like French fencing, is the most complicated sword fighting style in history, and they like apparently they trained for like hours and hours and hours and hours to do that fight, and when they got to the set, they had found out that the terrain had made their original choreography like unworkable. But they had practiced so much that when they did and they put on screen, right? It ended up looking amazing. That fight is so good. And you know, they joke about like footwork. But like next time you're watching it, watch the footwork. It's the most important part, mm-hmm. because if you don't know your surroundings, you can't move. Like it's amazing that, you know, it's the wide shot the whole time. Like you'll never see that today. Yeah. Watch the Star Wars fights. Like you'll never see it. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's something I realized like on my 50th watch through, mm-hmm. and I researched, but it's just that scene alone is amazing. And it showed like the weird commitment that they had to this film.
Totally. Bill Goodman, when he talked to Rob Reiner about doing this, he said that fight scene is the second greatest sword fight in the modern era of film. And Rob Reiner asked, okay, well, what's the first then? And he says, well, it's the fight that comes at the end of the film between Inigo Montoya and the six-fingered man. which is very interesting. But yes, I love that sequence. That's one that I think grabs you as a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old or whatever, when you're watching it for the first time and you don't really realize, to your point, how incredibly well choreographed that is, and how you don't really think about that's them the whole time. That's Manny Patinkin and Cary Elwes the whole time. The only stunts in that film or in that scene, are when they do like flips and stuff.
Yeah. And when does Return of the Jedi come out? 83?
83, yeah.
And it's a 4-year difference. The guy playing Darth Vader is in a suit. Mm. Mark Hamill is a young man, younger than both of these actors, I would assume, at the point. And that Return of the Jedi fight is not good, right? Mm. Like, sure. The Empire one has moments, and it's the energy and the emotion that you remember behind it.
Right.
But then you look at that and you look at this. And I even remembered, like, watching this and then watching Star Wars and be like, wow, this fight's lame.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when you, as a kid, when I'm going at this point, when I go and sword fight with I had these Nerf swords at the point.
Classic.
That were like fence, they had little fencing panels on them that the idea was like to knock out the other person's panel on like the hand guard, which is super cool detail. But like my brother and I would go and fight with these in the hallway, and we very quickly went from Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader to Inigo Montoya and Wesley or whatever, or the six finger man and stuff. Cause it's an incredible fight scene. And, it's certainly a different kind of beast than what you're going to get in most modern action movies, whether it's, swords and shields or, like Jason Bourne's rolled up magazine or whatever. Like it's a different sort of feel. It's very, traditional. Yeah, it's very traditional in that sense, but that's part of, I think, its charm and adds to the overall charm of the entire movie. Yeah, man, you have I watched this movie this time around, and again, I hadn't seen it probably, I would guess, 3-4 years, something like that. But I watched it almost in the background. Like I really wasn't even paying that much attention, which I usually, I'm even for movies that I've seen a lot of times, I, for this podcast, if we're doing a throwback, I really try to lock in and pay attention as best I can, because I want to bring as best of a critique as I can to this stupid podcast. But but this one, I've seen it so many times that almost every single scene in the movie, I could quote it from start to finish, and there's almost no detail left for me to pull out of it that I haven't seen, a dozen times before. I watched it this time around with the commentary on, which is not something I don't really like commentaries. I prefer to just be in the movie that I'm watching. But Rob Reiner's, but I've seen this movie so many daggone times, it was like, well, maybe I can draw something from Rob Reiner. But yeah, it's like, I feel like I could sit down and map out this entire movie in great detail from start to finish, and I'm not sure I would miss 10 lines, let alone a scene or anything. And so, it's one that you take that sword fight, you take the conversation on the boat, you take the battle of wits, the ROUSs, the pit of despair, on down the list. And it's like, yeah, of course I remember that. Of course, who hasn't
the marriage.
Who hasn't been to a wedding where they do the freaking marriage bit, which is just, we got to stop that. But yeah, and it, on into I've always thought that Wesley's bit at the end of To the Pain was really well scripted. It's borderline cheesy, but it's perfect for that setting, and it works really well within the context. And then to have Chris Sheridan's character, Prince Humperdinck, finish with, "I knew he was buffing. I knew he was buffing." This is great.
So good.
It's great.
So good.
So it works perfectly. We haven't talked about, and I'm mostly done, but you may have another 2 hours to go on this, but I think Billy Crystal, that may be the sequence that's not true. The sequence that I appreciate the most will forever be My Name is Inigo Montoya, You Kill My Father, Prepare to Die. But
film, right? Yeah. Like in film.
Yeah. Well, pretty much the GPS scene and Now You See Me is number one, but everything else, that's fine. It's fine to be second place to that. I think as I grow older, the more I watch the movie, the sequence that jumps out to me as just from the sheer, at least from the comedic side of things, but the brilliance of the performance is Billy Crystal and Carol Kane with Miracle Max. That's the one that, after having seen this 100 times, that's probably the one that I look forward to the most in the movie. When that scene is coming up, I sat down and I kind of get locked in again from whatever else I was doing while watching the movie. You know, that is all Billy Crystal, just kind of at his peak, really, just doing a Billy Crystal bit that works beautifully within the film, I think.
Yeah, I laugh so hard every time he talks about the mutton, lettuce, tomato.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yes. Like, my fantasy football team, and, like, if I have to name a team, I name it the Brute Squad. Like,
you are like, the Brute Squad.
You are the Brute Squad. Yeah, so it's so good. Like, he's, like, so good at improvising. Like, him and, like, Robin Williams are just kind of unparalleled.
Yeah.
Actors for their time at that, you know, at that role. So he's so hilarious. And when I was a kid, like, I didn't know that was him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
Like, I put this on and watched City Slickers 2 days later and not know it's the same guy.
Right. Right. Well, that's good. I'm about tapped out. If you've got anything else you want to bring up, we can do that, or we can move on to grades here.
I don't, I mean, I just, you know, I love so much about this movie. Like, the Inigo Montoya, Andre the Giant, and what's his name? Vicini, what's the actor's name?
Wallace Shawn.
Like, I think that, you know, you get, those three actors are so perfect for their roles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That, like, they, if you get three act, like, and they're not even the lead, right?
Right.
They're not technically, if you had three actors who are not as good as them, this movie is just not as good. I think they, in a sense, they carry the film, right?
100% agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. Secretly, like, a real key. If you're making a movie, especially one that's not the biggest budget, you can go a long way towards helping your film succeed or helping your film earn its kind of stripes and its the respect of its audience by getting your supporting cast right. Like, if we see that over and over and over again, where I feel like there's a lot of times where I watch a movie and I think, you know, the lead wasn't very good in that, but if he just would have had some help, that would have taken some of the pressure off how I felt about him or her. This is one that really, especially, you know, Cary Elwes is who he is, and he had established himself pretty well, but Robin Wright hadn't at all.
Right, yeah.
And I think I don't know, it goes a long way if you're able to surround, in some ways, I think it makes a lot more sense. If you have a certain amount of money for, you know, your top six actors, you might think about spending a third of it at the top and distributing some of the rest instead of 3/4 of it at the top and taking whatever you can get from there on. I think this is a movie that makes that kind of makes an argument for that sort of casting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna go back to this a lot because, like, the time, but look at Star Wars, right? Like, Mark Hamill, unknown, Carrie Fisher, unknown,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they supported the cast with Harrison Ford,
right?
Like legendary actor Alec Guinness and Peter mm-hmm. Cushing, who I think gives the best performance in that film. But, like, the main villain, like, David Prowse in that suit, in the Vader suit, is right. Terrible. It's mm-hmm. terrible. Mark Hamill, not great. Carrie Fisher, not great. I mean, it's George Lucas, so you can't really blame them for not being good.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the little bits about that, like the, you know, giving Alec Guinness screen time and then shifting it to Peter Cushing, you know, opposite Vader, those little things, I think, really help the legitimacy of a movie like this.
Sure.
And the same thing with The Princess Bride.
Yeah, totally agree. That's a great way to put it, a great ender. So let's grade it. I don't think it's going to be a huge mystery, but for me, Princess Bride is an F minus. Is an A plus, and one that you know, truly stands the test of time. It helps that it's a sort of a period piece, and so it adds to its timelessness. But this is a movie that I expect in 30, hopefully 30 years, my son is showing this movie to his kids, and that it still holds the same kind level of appreciation, and I have every faith that it will. So it's an A plus for me.
Yeah, this is an A plus. This is in my top 5 to 10 favorite movies of all time. The more I rewatch it and talk about it, the more I think I like it more than any individual Star Wars movie. You know, it doesn't have the big overall cultural impact, but you know, moving on, this is just, I give a lot of credit. If you listen to my podcast, I give a lot of credit for doing exactly what you set out to do and making the perfect film that you set out to make. And I think I think this is, like, this embodies that perfectly. Like Logan, like, you know, Scott Pilgrim, Baby Driver, right? The directors and the writers made the exact film they wanted to make. And I think, like, you know, you might not like the movie, but he made the film he wanted to make.
Sure. Yeah.
And A plus for me, you know?
Totally. I totally agree. Well, it's been good, man. Ariel, where can we find you on the, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me at Dread Pirate Rada, which is a callback to this wonderful, wonderful film.
Awesome. And your podcast is called Geek 101.
Right. We just talked our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series, which turned 25 awesome. Last week.
Sweet. Love yeah. Batman the Animated Series. That's a huge one for me. Cool. Well, you can find me at Bill. You can find me at BGill12 on the Twitter. You can find us on Twitter at Mad About Movies. You can find us on Instagram, Mad About Movies Podcast. Find our website, madaboutmoviespodcast.com. The Mad About Movies Podcast newsletter hopefully will be out sometime this week. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, every place in the world where you can get a podcast. Make sure you leave us a 5-star review on the old iTunes. That helps grow the show quite a bit. Next week, we're going to be back with, I believe, American Assassin, which I'm excited to talk about. And until next time, we will see you at the cinema. Good luck storming the castle. Goodbye.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face.
They're making me ya-ya. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs.
They're calling again.